Good evening. Welcome to the Salyer Report. Today is September 4th, 2014. We're almost at sweater weather. It's one of my favorite times of year. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. I want to tell you about two upcoming events. We're having a lunch with Catherine in Albuquerque on September 24th. I'll be stopping on my way out to California, and I hope if you're in that area, you will join us. We sent invitation to folks in that general area, but you can also access it from the blog or the resource page once you log in. And if you're at all interested, we'd love to see you. We have great conversations. You'll often want to meet the people in your area who have very similar values and interests, and it's a great way for us to get you personally to meet each other in a quiet forum where we're free to talk. The second one I'm very excited about, John Rappaport, Joseph Farrell, and I have decided to go forward with a day and a half event, November 8th and 9th, south of San Francisco in Menlo Park. Our working title is How to Live a Happy and Inspired Life and Help Others Do the Same, despite the big pink breakaway civilization elephant in the room. And we're going to be talking, we were going to do a backcasting, but decided, no, let's back up, talk a little bit about the history of successful conspiracies and the how-tos of success. It's really about tactics, strategies, and how to outwit the obstacles at a time like this, and how to help each other do it as well. So I think for those of you, there's a lot of great people in the Bay Area, so I'm hoping some will come. And that will be a very, very rich conversation. Our theme tonight is Divide and Conquer Meltdown. I keep bringing this up because it is so, so important to me that we help protect our subscribers from this trap. I keep watching people being drawn down in the vortex who I thought would never, ever fall prey to this. I delinked links this week on the blog to Red Ice Radio. They're having what I would describe as a multicultural culturalism breakdown or sort of meltdown. You're seeing the kind of social engineering going on in Europe and Sweden, and it's very disturbing. But they've sort of gotten into the subject of white genocide, which I think is a very incomplete map. If you look at what's going on with genocide, everybody's being targeted. It's not just this group or that group. It's happening to everybody. And if you listen to any particular group talk about what's being done to them that's horrible and fair, what you realize is, hey, you know, it's happening to the other 20. And I think to a certain extent, they're lashing out at the wrong people and spiraling into emotionalism. So there's too much disinformation getting in. And I think that, you know, falling for that is a trap, and it's a trap that can eat up a lot of time and unfortunately eat up a lot of time of the people who associate with them. And it's too bad because they've done an enormous amount of good work. And my attitude is it's a free world. You're free to say whatever you want, but the reality is if you're, you know, we're very interested in nurturing the best and the brightest of Western civilization, whatever it is, it's not spiraling down into that kind of emotionalism. We also had a subscriber. We had quite a back and forth on the Zach Taylor Border Wars interview. If you want to check it out, a subscriber said he was a homophobe and both Zach and I responded. And I'm afraid sometimes when you hear a person like Zach Taylor warn you very courageously about real danger, it's very easy to, rather than face that danger and deal with it, attack the messenger for being something other than perfect. And the reality is I've lived through that process where I have to be more and more perfect, and I have to be more and more perfect, and I have to be more and more perfect. And finally you realize, wait a minute, can we deal with the issues that I'm trying to warn you about and I'm risking my life to protect you from? It's very frustrating if you're in the Zach Taylor role. So it reminded me again that the divide and conquer issues are designed to do just that, to make it easy and attractive to pick each other over on our imperfections or things that we just literally make up so that we don't have to organize to find the bigger problems. And of course, at the heart of the Salieri model and Salieri investment strategy is trying to find ways of aligning with people where you can agree with them and get something done and not drown into emotionalism. There's more divide conquerors also going around Ferguson, Missouri. I got several questions on that. and I posted one of my emails that I wrote to a subscriber, and it's posted in the subscriber comment area. So check it out if you're interested. Lots of divide and conquer stuff going on there. Money in markets, the equity markets moved higher, spent a week generally over the S&P over 2000. Domestic markets very strong, finally closed down a little bit below 2000 today at 1,997. If you look at the one-year chart, it's amazing. For the last year, the S&P is up over 20%. The emerging markets have rallied, and now they're up almost as much, 18% for the year. The surprise of all is the long treasuries up approximately 10%. Who would have ever thought? And gold, of course, down 10% for the year. So, you know, moved up in March and now is trending down again. If you just look at the one month chart, S&P up about 2%, emerging markets almost as much, and TLT up about long treasuries up about 1.5%, and then gold down. So the question, of course, is where's the summer correction? And we are so overdue for 10 or 20% correction. People are sort of shaking their heads, waiting. And sure enough, today we got stimulus from Europe, the ECB signaling that they're going to offer stimulus of about 900 billion, about 700 billion euros. Surprisingly little bounce in the European stocks I was following. And I think that's because this was expected. It was good news for the US dollar index, which is now trading at about 83, 87, with some Wall Street firms predicting the dollar's headed back into parity with the euro, which we haven't seen since 2002. The big story in the market is we have a fair amount of IPOs scheduled for the fall. And of course, the mother of all IPOs is Alibaba. Alibaba is the largest online business in the world. And I put two blog posts up, which I'm going to note. One was just to give you a link to the prospectus. They filed their registration statement on August 27th. It's 429 pages long. Yes, I have read it. And if you want to understand the evolution of online business, it's really fascinating. So I encourage you to take a look. The link is up on the blog under the commentary Alibaba IPO. And their mission statement is there. It says, "Our mission is to make it easy to do business anywhere." You can tell they're really doing that. I think the business model is in many respects a much sounder one than the Amazon business model, because in fact they're providing marketplaces, sort of online malls. They have three different kind of marketplaces, but they don't compete directly with the small businesses that they serve and the businesses that they serve. And they're obviously opening up Chinese exports to the market globally. The proceeds from the IPO are not going to be brought back to China, but will be invested outside of the country. I'm assuming this is what's going to really build out their platform globally. If you look at their total marketplace, they have, as of the time of the filing of prospectus, well, as of June 30th, when they did the cutoff, they have 279 million active buyers. Now, let me give you a sense of that number. This is a company that was started by a Chinese school teacher. His name is Jack Ma, in 1998 in his living room. He then started the website in 98. He then gathered a group of people into his living room in 99 to start the company. And they now have an active customer base that is larger than the U.S. adult population. Now think about that. That's pretty amazing. That's really in 15 or 16 years. If you look at the total payment volume moving through their system, it's now $750 billion, which is, of course, bigger than most countries or many countries around the globe. But here's the most interesting statistic you will read in their prospectus, and that is that 32% of their gross merchandise volume goes across the mobile platform. And that means that 27%, here's what they say in their prospectus, that is up from 27.4% in the preceding 3 months and from 12% in the same period in the prior year. That is how fast the mobile transaction business is growing. And it underscores the challenge that every business around the world has. Let me just read you a statistic from Business Week that I put in the commentary, the second commentary I wrote, called One Mobile Market, One World. This year, 1.75 billion people will own smartphones, according to eMarketer. There are 4.5 billion mobile phone users overall and 7 billion people in the world. I thought the total population was greater. But if you look at the speed at which people are getting on smartphones and then the speed at which that makes it feasible for them to transact. Now, most Americans can transact without a mobile phone, but we are now taking mobile phones into populations that will then be brought into the financial system because they have a smartphone. So if you look at the speed at which this is building out and how it's changing the fundamental nature of retail distribution, it's quite extraordinary. And the Alibaba prospectus gives you a little sense of it. And it gives you a sense of how powerful the Asian juggernaut is as it begins to mature. I also noted in this article that a review of the World Exchange Association shows their research statistics that the global equity markets managed by the exchanges have grown from less than $10 trillion in 1990 to $68 trillion today. Now, what that means is, yes, we've been exploding the monetary base of the G7 nations. The reality is that monetary base is now spreading to securitize a much greater portion of the retail and wholesale flows and assets on the planet. Part of that is this explosion in the equity markets as we bring more and more countries and the emerging markets and the frontier markets in. And it's one of the reasons we don't have inflation, but it's important to remember it's just begun. This process of securitization outside the G7 is very, very young and it's growing. And as the smartphone system builds out, it's gonna explode even more. And so there's something happening which is very dynamic economically. It's interesting, if you look at the float on the exchanges in the emerging markets, what you see is it's much more microcap. So if you look at the really dynamic small business growth that's going on, not here, but in the emerging markets and the frontier markets, and it's very, very significant. Now, let's step back and look at the whole issue of the Anglo-American alliance and the G7 trying to establish dominance of a one world that now is growing explosively outside their system. We got a great question on our interview tonight for Anna Williamson. Somebody posted, a subscriber posted, a comment and said, you mentioned the same financial interests operating worldwide and how it may impact the global financial system. More specifically, it may continue the U.S. dollar dominant long after it would normally end up another destructed currency. Would you please expand on that thought? A decision, you know, we've talked about this many times on the Solari Report. A decision was made in the early 90s to pull capital out of the G7 nations and reinvest that capital globally in a way that the G7 financial interests could ultimately assert dominance over the whole globe. And that's been a muddled and murky process, but it's part of what I call the financial coup d'etat. And if you're interested, you know, I have many articles and there are many interviews that go into this. But essentially what we are watching globally with what's happening in the Ukraine, what's happening in Russia, what's happening in Syria, what's happening in Iraq and Iran, all of these issues are part of the squabble of whether or not the Western world is going to assert a dominant control and implement one global financial model or not. Now, that process got going in the mid-90s. At this point, it's gotten a bit out of control. If you watch what's happening in the Ukraine, I would say it's pretty out of control. But essentially, one of the things that's happening is the weak get picked over. So as we talked about the Ukraine not developing the way that Poland did or Russia did, and of course, it was very easy for corporate interests in NATO to move in. I think the real goal in the Ukraine is to get Russia in the model. And part of what Anne and I talk about in the interview tonight is the steps that were taken in the 90s to assert control of the oil and gas interests in Russia And Putin's efforts since then to sort of reassert national sovereignty. Part of the issue that is sort of throwing Russia back into play is the Arctic discoveries and a squabble in the Arctic about who's going to assert control there. I posted an article on the blog and a commentary this week. It's off the homepage now, but you can see it there. If you click back, Exxon's $900 billion Arctic prize at risk after Ukraine. So part of this is a debate on the about the oil and gas and sort of making sure Russia is in the model. And the reason the Western model needs Russia sort of in the basket is because of the strength and the growth of China. So part of this is trying to make sure Russia and Eastern Europe stay in the European and the Western basket instead of ally with China. Of course, you know, if the West doesn't succeed in sort of bringing Russia to heel, then of course we could see Russia closer to China, and that's part of the moves you've seen. One of the big questions right now on the Ukraine is sort of what's happening with the IMF money. That story gets very interesting as we see Lagarde put under formal investigation and clearly an effort to tie her hands and bring her to heel at the IMF. So don't be surprised to see her out and somebody else in, but certainly the powers that be controlling what she does. So the question is exactly who's zooming whom, because we see the Ukraine take down more money and now rumors that a lot of the money they've been taking down is not really going into the Ukraine, but it's going offshore. Many times in the 90s and certainly during the rape of Russia, the money that went to the IMF immediately headed back to Wall Street to sort of take care of all sorts of different bondholders. So there's a big question about where is the IMF money that's headed into the Ukraine exactly going? And that is almost impossible to tell. The French politics around this are getting very dangerous. It's not just what happened to Lagarde, but we see the government dissolved and then finally the French warship canceled. France had said they wouldn't do it. And you're talking about very big money there and very big transactions, and the French abrogating their contracts to the Russians. So that's a pretty ugly position. And you wonder how much more this squabble is going to really hurt the European economy. Lots of questions this week from subscribers on who is ISIS and what is really going on in Syria and Iraq. We know, it's a great comment. I put it up on the blog from John Rubino. Let me just read you one of his comments. Came in on August 25th. The Islamic State, ISIS, has set a modern-day emergent threat record by going from obscurity to existential global menace in what seems like a matter of weeks. But as with most overnight sensations, there was a longer gestation period outside of the limelight. And like most military threats of the past decades, it was nurtured by, you guessed it, us. The U.S., of course, has history of arming erstwhile allies only to have them become enemies in later conflicts. So when we started helping the opposition to Syria's dictatorship, thus producing ISIS, more than a few people saw parallels to past policy mistakes, on and on and on. It's very interesting. The reality is the Islamic State has now asserted command of more than a few Iraqi fields. And if you look at the flow of oil and potential cash and oil smuggling that they can do, it's quite significant. And I suspect a lot of the beheadings, pictures in the orchestrated media is all designed to finally get the U.S. to support going to war. If you step back and look at sort of the dance around Russia and the dance around the Middle East, the reality is that the Bush administration movement or basically what they did in the Middle East dramatically increased cash flows into the military defense establishment. And I think to a certain extent, what we're seeing are two things, two dynamics. One is the G7 and the Anglo-American Alliance trying to get everybody in the model, and they're running into a great deal of pushback all over the globe. They're stuck in the mud, and they're angry, and they're running out of time, and they're pushing for a breakout. So I think part of it is that. But I also think you need, you know, the military-industrial complex is needing more and more cash flow. And so you're really seeing an effort by the machinery to push for war. It's a little bit scary because the culture of these groups has gotten very, very dark. And so I think the tension in the fall is going to be, can they do it? One other thing I wanted to note in terms of getting everybody in the model, a great subscriber sent in a note on Ecuador, which is entirely true. Martin Armstrong had posted something about a new electronic currency going forward that's really dollar based in Ecuador, and pointing out this is a prototype for what's coming globally. I agree with Martin. It's a but the subscriber also pointed out that very recently Ecuador did a deal with Goldman Sachs where Goldman gets Ecuador's gold, and then suddenly now Ecuador is doing a digital currency. It's sort of a 1-2 punch, and it's a perfect example of pulling somebody into the model. So it wouldn't surprise me if Ecuador is an early prototype, and so very, very much part of this model thing. We're coming into the anniversary of 9/11, and there are all sorts of rumors. I keep getting questions about false flags and whether or not we believe there's going to be a cyber attack of American banks that are used to as an excuse to go to war with Russia. I think the reality is that the chances of another very serious false flag are 5 or 10%. So I think a lot of this is rumors, not to say that there aren't people who wouldn't do something like that to get a war geeked up. If you look at the state of play, it's worth going back and watching a movie that I recommended in Let's Go to the Movies, Kevin Costner in 13 Days. Where you see, it's a replay of the Kennedy administration, where you see the President of the United States and the Soviet Premier conspire to keep their respective military establishments from engineering a war. I'm not saying that Obama and Putin are in accord, but I think there are a lot of private interests who are doing everything they can to engineer a war. They're really looking to break Russia and get Russia into the fold now and get them into the model now. And so it's a if you look at sort of all the engineering of war, it's definitely there. And so take a minute and pray for peace, because we really need to calm this down. Wanted to point out, speaking of cyber war, Apple denied that that a breach was the cause of all the celebrity nude selfies running around the internet. My vote is with Apple on this one. Someone was running a hit trying to make it look like there was a breach when there wasn't, is my guess. And it didn't work. Apple seemed to have managed it. Certainly they have the credibility to do it. But it's a reminder of the roughness of the game, because you have major players using these kind of cyber warfare tactics on each other. Federal banking regulators finalized a liquidity coverage rule. I talk about it in my interview with Joe Mizak, which we will publish next week. Municipal bonds got thrown out of the pot, but it's another example of the feds tightening up the sort of the game for the big banks. Back to school. Everyone in the United States is now, and in many other countries, experiencing that back to school experience. And I will tell you, there is a quiet culture shock going on all over the country as more and more parents realize what the Common Core curriculum is. And frankly, if vaccines or Obamacare didn't get parents to understand that what we're dealing with fundamentally is psychopathic, Common Core is really doing it. It's amazing. One of the things that a lot of parents are beginning to realize is that the system is, to a certain extent, hopeless, and they're just going to have to work around it. And what's interesting is, at the same time that the system is becoming just unbelievably and offensively perverted and hopeless, the internet and online access globally is providing unbelievable resources for education. So if you're in the emerging markets and you're in a village, but you've got a smartphone, you can get online, go to the Khan Academy and get a first-rate education, the kind of education you cannot now get in an American school because you're overloaded with Common Core curriculum. But if you're in the emerging markets, you're in the frontier markets now, for relatively very low cost, you can get the best math, science, reading, and writing in the world, and you don't have to waste time with all the nonsense of Common Core curriculums and disinformation and things like that. There's an editorial in the Wall Street Journal this week about a professor at Stanford who teaches an intro econ class, and he got permission to put his intro econ class up online and then do all sorts of things with his students in person, but to allow people all over the world to attend. They got 15,000 people attending globally. Can you imagine? It's a wonderful description of the extraordinary things that can happen with these kinds of resources. So I think parents disgusted with Common Core are going to redesign their children's education using these kinds of tools. They're not going to wait. The only problem is they have a terrible handicap that the people in the frontier markets and emerging markets don't have, which is they got to send their kids to school where they spend an enormous amount of time listening to things that are not useful and are not a good use of their time. So exactly how this is going to work out, I don't know. But you've got the most intelligent and caring parents in the world realizing through this mechanism that our leadership has really reached a very psychopathic stage. And, so between Common Core vaccines and Obamacare, it's going to be very interesting to see what this quiet revolution looks like. Posted on the blog, I noted that the most popular Apple App Store category is the number two was education. So it's all part of the educational workarounds. The Apple Store is now experienced over 50 billion downloads of apps. Imagine that. I also posted a story on robot bartenders and bumper cars in Royal Caribbean's new ship set to sail, Quantum of the Seas. It's just a little interesting example of the way robots are rolling out all over the society, all over the economy. But you're going to see a lot of that over the next 2 or 3 years. But here it comes. Our hero tonight is Pete Larson, who is the head of an institute in South Dakota. He's a paleontologist, and he is very much a part of the story that we have in Let's Go to the Movies tonight. It's a documentary called Dinosaur 13 about the sort of Fed theft of a fossil a T-Rex that Pete and his crew at the Institute found in South Dakota. And if you ever doubted that when the elites decide they want to own and control something, they can use taxpayer-funded resources to get it, this is a perfect example. The reason I wanted to have Pete be our hero tonight is here's a man who's gone through an absolutely hideous experience. He's had one of the great triumphs of his career pulled out from under him and his team, his institute threatened. He was incarcerated and put in jail for 2 years. It's a hideous story. And yet when it was over, he came out, the institute made it through, and he has proceeded to do other great digs, other great finds, and still remains a remarkable person who's going and accomplishing great things in his field. But I pointed out that, as this is true for fossils, so it is for fossil fuels. And it's amazing that the model that we're watching in the Ukraine or in the Middle East is operating in the Black Hills of South Dakota. And it's also a story of sort of what happens to a town. It was a Rapid City, South Dakota that very much lost an amazing asset that would have been great for the town. But it's a very well done documentary. And it's worth watching. Fascinating story. Ask Catherine. We got several recommendations for reading, which I've read the material or looked at it. And whenever I pull things out that I think would be great for the blog, you send me many good recommendations, and we can't necessarily put them all up, but I really thank you for sending them. Please send more. I've answered a few offline just because they were sensitive. And then we got one recommendation for Ambrose Evans Pritchard's interview, which we posted. It's got a very good description of the Treasury Sanction Toolkit, and I think it's brief, but it's worth watching. Someone else noted Rappaport's great coverage of the CDC whistleblower, which has been excellent. I posted some things, but I would really encourage you to check out that coverage at No More Fake News, another sort of chink in the armor of the sort of fake vaccine story. One question asked said to me, I know you don't support Bitcoin, but what about Dogecoin? No idea what it is. I'll try and check it out. Somebody asked me if I knew how we could go about safe app usage. Wouldn't I love to know? We will make an effort to try and understand that. I find apps to be very tricky, and it's very, there's, to my knowledge, I know of nothing that can really make them safe, and it's one of the reasons I very rarely use one. We built one. I believe ours is safe. It's a silver and gold calculator, and you can get it for Android or iPhone. If you go to our blog and click on the calculator logo, it'll take you to the website, and it'll help you, point you to where you can download those apps, and it's up at the Apple Store too. But we will continue to look for ways of figuring out safe app use. If you look at how the mobile world is organized, I just don't think it's safe yet. And in that vein, I did a review of 10 new financial websites that do either financial planning, brokerage, or money management. The idea being bring the IT world to kind of reinvent and ease access to these kind of services. I was stunned because they all seem to operate on the premise that you can trust all online systems, that you don't need to worry about privacy, and there's no risk in the financial system. It's sort of everything's fine, and it's pretty frightening. And I will look for an opportunity to talk about that more because it's something we'll take in depth. But the reality is, you know, this was brought to you by people who didn't seem to notice the financial crisis or what the real risks were in the system. It was pretty scary. I signed up for, to get access to all of them. And in the process, I'm now getting inundated by emails and phone calls from people wanting to have me give them 100% of my financial data to complete strangers. And I find it all terrifying, but they're all very chipper. Our interview tonight is with an extraordinary reporter and author, Ann Williamson. I don't know of anyone better on the topic of what has really been going on the ground in Russia and the Ukraine, except possibly John Laughlin. I'd love to get him on as well. Joseph Farrell just sent me an email before I started to talk to you this evening, and he said, I just listened to the Williamson interview on the Ukraine. It is the very best I've heard so far. And I agree, this is somebody who really knows her stuff. And I was delighted to be able to get her on. It's a long interview, but if you really want to understand the backstory in the Ukraine, it's the way to do it. So that's it for this evening. In closing, don't forget about Albuquerque if you're in that part of the world, September 24th. And again, let us know if you want an invitation to the November event, particularly if you don't get one next week. If you've expressed interest before, you're definitely on the list. September 11th, next week, I'm going to be speaking with Joe Mizek. Joe is the dean of the Municipal Bond Reporters. He covered the municipal market for many years at Bond Buyer and then went to Bloomberg, which is sort of the definitive post. And we do a municipal market overview. He's just published his half-year stat book, and a lot of fascinating things going on quietly in that market, which is, it's about a $4 trillion market, very significant. There are a lot of people in our subscriber base who would love to buy a good 10-year municipal if they could get 4 or 5%. We're not even close in our dreams so far. But nevertheless, if you want to understand what's going on in the United States, that's a very important market. You can see a lot about what's happening in state and local government. And then on September 18th, a wonderful, wonderful attorney who's been with us once before is going to join us again, Jo Klein Sieberhaar. She is both attorney, author, and ran as chairwoman the largest hospice in Iowa. And we're going to be talking about managing end of life. She's written books on legacy wills, and she's also written a book on healthcare proxy, which is where she joined us on the Solari Report. We live in a culture where many of us are kept as strangers to death. We're afraid of death, and as a result, we miss out on some of the most important passages of family, friends, and then, of course, our own. And I find, I will just tell you, some of the finest experiences of my life have been helping friends and families in the process of dying and being with them when they die. And it's an extraordinary sort of passage between two dimensions. And for those of us who've made friends with death and had a lot of experience with death, what I can tell you is this is something you want to learn about and you want to get good at. Because in a lifetime, we're all going to die, but we're going to have to experience the death of many, many people around us. It's just the nature of who and what we are. And if you can be part of making death an experience, which is an enriching experience or one that you're good at, I assure you it can make your life a much more amazing and positive experience. So that one's going to be good because Joe is just so extraordinary at this whole topic. And I really can't think of anybody better. So until next week with Joe Mizak, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.